Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 168 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her sexuality. Well, everyone's sexuality. We have a terrific show coming up. Before we begin, just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your reminder to click onto iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show. Yeah, man, we're just sitting here waiting to hear from you because we love your feedback. So bring it on down. I'll remind you at the end of the episode as well. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
So, I'm reading this great piece in the New York Times, How to Stop Rushing into Love. And it quotes an expert. And this expert is our guest, Dr. Ian Kerner. And Ian is a licensed psychotherapist, nationally recognized sex therapist. You might have heard him on NPR, National News. He's an author of numerous books, including the best-selling classic, She Comes First. Yeah, you heard me right. That's what it means. And in this wonderful piece in the New York Times, it was really all about the issue of dating, about falling in love, about beginning to build a relationship with some really interesting nuances. Sex, love, and compatibility don't always come as a package. Remember that one for sure. And then, rushing into love, might seem like human nature, but only fools fail to evolve. Ah, I love that. Ian, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Hello, happy to be here.
Well, you certainly have a fantastic career. I've been reading up on all of your wonderful work once I discovered you, and I think that our listeners out there really need to understand what you're all about. You have spent a number of years looking at this whole issue of sex therapy, and I'm fascinated to know a little bit about your practice. So what are the most common sex problems you see in your practice? Because I'll bet a lot of our listeners have their own stereotypic thought about what that really is. And I'll bet you'll blow our minds that it isn't.
I have a pretty unique practice in that pretty much 100% of my practice, whether I'm working with individuals or couples, people are dealing with some aspect of sexuality, their relationship, their identity, their feelings about sex. So I kind of get to swim in the world of sexuality. In terms of the most common problems that I see, I would certainly say desire and desire discrepancy. Somebody wanting to be wanted by a partner and not being wanted, or wanting to want and not knowing why they're not wanting. But I see an awful lot of desire discrepancy or mismatched libidos, or one partner being low desire. Sometimes it's not about desire, but about a difference in erotic temperament, where, you wake up one day and you realize, wow, I'm a little more of a thrill seeker, an experience seeker, a novelty seeker when it comes to sexuality, and my partner is not. So I see certainly those kinds of differences quite a bit, and often they haven't really been talked about. They've just sort of been experienced. In men, I deal a lot with we could call them sexual function issues, erectile disorder. And I'm seeing a lot of erectile disorder in younger and younger men, guys in their 30s and even in their 20s. And so that's been a change in my practice. In women, I certainly
What is that all about? I mean, this rise in young men with ED. What's going on?
Well, the thing that typically gets blamed is pornography. because we do live in a world where more porn is sort of being streamed or downloaded on a daily basis than Amazon, Netflix, Twitter combined. So it's easy to blame porn because porn is so prevalent and so part of the fabric of sort of sexual self-expression. But when I'm actually sitting down with these men who are suffering from ED, porn really rarely comes into the picture. What more comes into the picture is guys who, you know, were sort of brought up to succeed in a lot of different areas. They were supported. They were scaffolded in a lot of different ways, whether it was, you know, making friends or succeeding at school or succeeding on team sports. But they really kind of grew up in kind of a sexual vacuum. There wasn't any communication around sex. There wasn't any mirroring. And they're men who were sort of, I think, sort of educated to and socialized to be ambitious, to succeed, to individuate. And so they have extremely high standards. And they've often had quite a bit of success in other parts of their lives. But this area of sexuality, they were kind of like thrown into the deep end before they were even taught how to do like the doggy paddle. And so their first experiences of sexuality were fraught with anxiety and a sense of pressure and a fear of performance. Yeah. And that kind of became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And, you know, once you sort of let that anxiety sort of creep into you a little bit, it's really hard to get away from. And so, you know, these are men who, you know, going back into their earliest sexual experiences had anxiety, and that anxiety caused erectile disorder. I mean, I think, you know, part of, you know, my first book was called She Comes First, and it was a pretty successful book. And one of the themes in that book was to help men to find ways to make love, you know, with more than just their penis, or to think about sex as more than just intercourse, and to get out of the shadow of what I sort of back then labeled the intercourse discourse. And I think still today, 20 years after writing the book, most men really equate being good in bed or good at sex with their ability to have intercourse. And so I think it creates a lot of pressure, and it's also a very narrow lens.
Yeah, I think your point is incredibly well taken. You know, it's so interesting. It's almost like an achievement thing, as it were. You know, it's metrics, it's goals, it's objectives. I mean, and that's the way it's really sold. And I think that, you know, because we have social media, because we have multimedia out there, I mean, I hope I'm not overstepping or whatever, but I think that, you know, young men are getting, or men in general, are getting pummeled with these media messages that, unless you, you know, kind of pull it off like Brad Pitt or, you know, whatever, that you're in trouble. And I think what you're saying is that they almost have to be, young men almost have to be retaught that it's not about just pulling off porn off the internet or, you know, listening to what some guy was, you know, beating his chest about in the locker room, but that it's much, much richer and more complicated. And that's a good
thing. And I think it's also about going into sex and feeling like your partner isn't expecting a performance, but rather is expecting a connection and feeling like you can feel safe and comfortable and attuned with somebody, and that sex isn't an audition and isn't a competition. So I think it's also the energy that men are able to put out relationally and sexually and open themselves up to receive.
Yeah. And I think that that is, you know, this is really important because, I just think that this is a real generational thing, don't you? That if you're looking at somebody and talking to somebody who's 50 or 60, I think that they'd call themselves kind of old school. They were raised within a different cultural environment when it came to this kind of thing. There was actually something called dating, who knew, instead of hooking up and, you know, swiping right or left or whatever the issue is today. It's just it's a very different thing. And I think that teenagers, kids in their 20s, and certainly even millennials are all submerged in this culture. And, you know, based upon your expertise, Ian, where is this taking us? What's going to happen?
You mean, you know, based on sort of, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, I'm increasingly finding that, you know, people are having a hard time how to occupy a sort of a sexual space or a sexual channel and be uninhibited and let themselves go and be able to be with a partner and see the partner as sort of somebody that they can sexualize and, eroticize and even see as sort of the object of their fantasies. I mean, I think to really get the most out of sex and to occupy that sexual channel, you really have to have kind of, a sense of safety with your partner and a sense of security. And then on top of that, you have to be able to have a sense of risk. And I don't know that we are really, preparing people or certainly preparing, you know, young people with how to really create that sense of emotional safety and security in a relationship and how to really, sustain a kind of a multidimensional, attachment, but also how to take risks as well. I mean, we live, you know, certainly I practice out in New York City and, in New York City, most of the relationships that couples come in with are not particularly gendered. They're more egalitarian. You know, very often both partners are working or both partners are taking care of the kids and both partners are splitting up the chores and the grocery list. And there's a lot of, respect and there's a lot of collaboration, and there's a lot of transparency. And that's all great from a relational perspective. But when people come in and talk about sex, they're talking about their fantasies. They're talking about things to them that are taboo, things to them that may be dirty or naughty, and things that sort of fly in the face of how they're conducting their relationships. And so you have to be able to do both. You have to be able to have that respectful, mutual relationship. But then you also have to be able to kind of jump into a sexual space and be vulnerable and take risks.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I'm probably generalizing like hell, but what the heck? I'll do it anyway. And that is, I see a lot of the younger generation being able to hop from place to place when they do their career, for instance, that they're bold and they take risks with that. So, you know, they may work with a startup for 2 years, but they have absolutely no goal of hanging out there and waiting for that gold watch 40 years from now. Instead, it's almost like, where's the next bling? Where's the next shiny thing? And they continue to grow. You know, it's really true. And so if that's true, I wonder, Ian, let's explore this for a minute, if that also parallels relationships.
In what way?
Well, in the sense that where's the next bling? Where's the next new thing? And that if things could be as simple as a hookup and a swipe to the right or left, then it's the same kind of ethos, which is it comes, it goes, we go. We change.
Right. Or it's looking, or it's looking for that psych, it's looking for that thrill, it's looking for that turn on. In something
the bling.
Just can be very one dimensional. It's just looking for it in a new person, in a new body, in a new set of body parts. I mean, probably one of the main issues that I deal with couples, is boredom and a loss of excitement. And so I'll sit with a couple and they'll be bored sexually. There won't be excitement. They're not interested or anticipating sex. And when I talk with them about the kind of sex that they're having, it's a very limited menu of physical behaviors, and it's really lacking in psychological exciters. It's lacking in a kind of a psychological dimension. And so when you're not able to bring a psychological dimension into your bedroom, when you're not able to bring an element of the taboo into your bedroom, then the only way you know how to get excitement is through a new and different body. And so I don't think that we are equipping ourselves or young people with a wide enough net to appreciate all of the different types of psychological excitement that can be captured with a single person.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing too is, if you look at peer pressure and just, you know, peers and their experience around these people, the young people, that you know, they're seeing everybody just sort of swipe and do their thing, and it's not that big a deal, and whoopee-doo. So looking cool that way, looking unattached, disconnected that way is cool. It's accepted. Whereas if you flash forward to someone who's, say, 60, right, with a 40-year or 35-year difference, whatever, at least 30-year difference, you're looking at a very different world. Then it was totally cool to be connected with someone. It was, you know, there was value seen in it. Versus today, where's the value? Also, at the same time, the whole institution of marriage, per se, is being reinvented and redefined. And also, its place in these young people's lives is quite different. So there's a lot of shakeup going on. And I think part of the fallout is what happens with relationships. It seems to me that it would have to. Am I over-reading that one, Ian?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, the flip side of all of this, though, is that we live in an age where there's also, there are a lot of challenges. And I certainly work with a lot of young people who are very bored of social media and very tuned into the phoniness of it and very burnt out on the treadmill of sort of Tinder and, you know, social dating, and, you know, definitely want, you know, some kind of authenticity and some kind of connection, and don't know exactly what they're looking for, but they know that they're not finding it. The flip side of that, though, is that there's probably more opportunity than there has ever been to create the kind of relationship and to create the kind of sex life and to show up the way that you want to, you know, more than ever. And so I work with, you know, couples who, are kind of still creating relationships and still going through the world with a partner, but they are opening themselves up to, all different kinds of psychological excitement and sexual adventurousness in different ways. Sometimes even if that's just within, you know, their own bedroom, there are couples who are exploring consensual non-monogamy and polyamory, and there are people who are exploring gender and sexual fluidity. So there are so many opportunities to truly express and to be authentic as well. And so I don't want to just, you know, focus on the cautionary side or the downside or the negative, because I'm also finding that there are opportunities available to young people that I didn't really experience growing up, you know, and things that I might have felt like, oh, I'm sort of alone in this or living with a silent desperation, I could really find, you know, mirrored out in the world. And so I'm also extremely, you know, optimistic about the opportunities that are available to people.
Interesting. And obviously, you know, you must see a lot of people now who are coming in and expressing almost like a pansexuality, a full spectrum sexuality, etc. Something that I know that you and I did not grow up with. Really in terms of being exposed to the fact that there is an existence to all of this. And what that really means in terms of relationships out there as well. You're absolutely right. It's sort of a brand new horizon out there that we probably never even knew would be able to exist until now. Now it's sort of like anything kind of, you know, rocks and rolls in a big way. You know, it's interesting. In this article that you were quoted in, I thought some of the stuff in this was just wonderful. You know, you gave some superb advice about this whole issue of, you know, rushing into into love, into a relationship. And you talk about, you know, think of a new relationship as a Venn diagram. You said there's a relational overlap, but you're still also an individual. The goal is to get the right size overlap while still maintaining a sense of individuality. You know, you and I have both watched people sort of sink in and immerse themselves with somebody else, and suddenly they're lost. Like, where'd you go? How can someone really feel as though they have a little bit more control over something like that as they're getting to know someone?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because I think, you know, often when we fall in love, we really want to enmesh with that person and we want to overlap with that person completely. And we know so little and we want to know everything and we're fascinated and we're curious. And so I think, you know, typically I often see relationships begin with that almost complete overlap. And then sometimes there's sort of a reflex reaction where at a certain point you realize you're losing yourself, or hold on, what happened to my family and my friends or my own identity? And you get scared of that sense of immersion and that sense of loss, and you kind of almost like have a reflex back to kind of re-expressing and re-experiencing your own individuality. And then hopefully you kind of get through that reaction and you can really figure out how much of yourself you want in a relationship and where that overlap really where you want it to be. And you know, paradoxically, ironically, we often pick people who have a different sense of what they want out of that overlap. And so I see this all the time. I've sort of seen it in my own life. I mean, I grew up, an only child of a single mom who had to really entertain myself. I was a latchkey kid. And I think my style of relating was sort of avoidant of a lot of intimacy because that was just sort of my comfort zone. And, you know, I think I picked somebody who was completely opposite, who, you know, grew up in a big family with lots of love and lots of communication and really wanted, you know, much more of an overlap than I did. And I think part of our relationship has sort of been this, this little bit of a tug of war. And I think my wife has, you know, sort of, expanded my ability to be in that relational space and, you know, made the relational space larger than I ever would have expected it to be. And I think in turn with me, she learned, how to be a little more individuated and how to have more of her own self and individuality and personhood. So I think it's a constant, dance. And, I think the best thing we can ask for is for our partners to carry around with them in their heads, an accurate picture of us. You know, if we can have an accurate picture of our partner in our own heads that we reflect upon and interact with when we think about them. And if we could really have a fully dimensional, accurate, picture, you know, then we can consistently create the right sized overlap.
I love it. You know, and in your quote, one of the things I remember so beautiful, that's so beautiful is, as you said, the goal is to get the right size overlap while still maintaining a sense of individuality, the balance between togetherness and differentiation. strong couples consist of strong individuals, and strong individuals are often bolstered by strong relationships. And that just really stuck with me. I thought that that was very powerful, and it really kind of brought most of this together. So as we're concluding this, this is just, I've been taking notes right and left because this has really been great. And there's a lot of grist for your thinking mill, you know, from this episode, Ian, because we're living in such a, you know, a state of upheaval now in our culture, especially as it relates to relationships. And pacing this, trying to make some sense of it, is so terribly important, because I think a lot of people are very confused. They're conflicted. They also have oftentimes not been mentored, both in terms of their families or somebody to help guide them. I wish everyone had an Ian out there to help, you know, to help them understand what's going on. But I just think that this is an extraordinarily interesting time in history. And that's one of the reasons why I really wanted you to be on the Her podcast, because it is just that important for people out there, our listeners, for the Her podcast, to hear from an expert that there's a lot of amazing, great things going on. At the same time, pace it, think it through, take a deep breath, and get ready to do some evolving yourself. Would that be a great way to put it all together, Ian?
Yeah, thank you. That's beautifully put. I really appreciate it. And it was a pleasure coming on to the show and being able to have a conversation with you.
Awesome. And I just want to make sure that everyone knows we've been talking to Dr. Ian Kerner. He is the author of a bestseller, She Comes First. Please grab that sucker, because this is so important. You'll learn things you need to know about her. And he is a licensed psychotherapist, nationally recognized sex therapist. And we have been really talking about something important, and that is how to stop rushing into love, but also all things, amazing changes that are going on within our culture today when it comes to relationships at all. So thank you, Ian. And everyone out there, please take a minute right now to hit iTunes and rate and review the show. We're sitting here waiting to hear from you because we love your feedback, want to hear from you. I'm Dr. Pam Peake, host of the Her podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peake or Twitter at Pam Peake MD. And remember to catch every episode of the Her podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today, and stay well.